nomination. William Howard Taft said that the farming and middle classes tended to build up a conservative, self-respecting community capable of self-government. In 1948, in an address on health care, President Truman said, "The fact that we have a well-informed, so-called middle class in this country is what makes it the greatest republic the sun has ever shone upon or ever will shine upon again." In 1955, speaking to the AFL-CIO, President Eisenhower brought the architect of communism into the conversation, saying, "The class struggle doctrine of Marx was the invention of a lonely refugee scribbling in a dark recess of the British Museum. He abhorred and detested the middle class. He did not foresee that in America, labor, respected and prosperous, would constitute, with the farmer and businessman, his hated middle class." The middle mattered, and as the middle grew, it mattered ever more. As long ago as the American founding, it was an accepted truth that an economic unit that was neither very rich nor very poor offered a republic vital political stability. Definitions of middle class are elusive and elastic. The scholar Ganesh Sitaraman holds with one offered by The Economist magazine. The journal edited by Walter Badgett of the Dignified and Efficient Construct of Constitutions. "To be middle class," Sitaraman wrote, summarizing the magazine's criteria, "means that you have enough spending money to provide for yourself and your family without living hand to mouth, but not enough to guarantee their future. Nothing, in other words, can be taken for granted, for there's always the risk that your prosperity might fall victim to time and chance." Whatever one's class status, there's a tendency for many to think that they are a Horatio Alger hero, an emblem of rugged individualism and singular success. The American ideal of what Henry Clay had called self-made men in 1832 is so central to the national mythology that there's often a missing character in the story Americans like to tell about American prosperity: government, which frequently helped create the conditions for the making of those men. Many Americans have never liked acknowledging that the public sector has always been integral to making the private sector successful. We often approve of government's role when we benefit from it, and disapprove when others seem to be getting something we aren't. Given the American Revolution's origins as a rebellion against taxation and distant authority, such skepticism is understandable, even if it's not well-founded. We have long proved ourselves quite capable of living with this contradiction, using Hamiltonian means, centralized decision-making, while speaking in Jeffersonian rhetorical terms, that government is best which governs least. The Pacific Railroad and Homestead Acts, signed by Lincoln, used the power of government to settle the West. The railway legislation gave federal support to the creation of a transcontinental railroad, a vast project that played a key role in making the United States an economic and cultural whole. Once the Golden Spike had joined the rails of East and West, the danger and duration of stagecoach rides gave way to the muscle and speed of locomotives. Able to carry dreamers west, ship crops east, and shrink the psychic distance of the continent. The homestead measures enabled settlers to claim small parcels of farmland, making new lives and livelihoods possible. The Morrill Act created land-grant universities, opening higher education to many throughout the country. The legislation of the Progressive Era brought a measure of humanity to the rigors of the Industrial Age, and a democratization of power through women's suffrage, the rise of primaries, and the direct election of senators. And when the prosperity of the Roaring Twenties proved short-lived, the New Deal, and particularly Social Security, redefined the individual's relationship to the state, knitting the public and private sectors together much more closely. While it took World War II to put a true end to the Great Depression, the work of the New Deal had already added a new and permanent dimension to the American experiment in the mid-20th century. The expectation that government could play a more direct role in individual lives. That expectation was met in World War II and its aftermath. First came immense defense spending that truly transformed the United States into what FDR in 1940 had called the Great Arsenal of Democracy. Then, while the war was still underway, the GI Bill of Rights, formerly called the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, would eventually help lift millions into previously unreachable economic and cultural spheres. Championed by the American Legion, the legislation provided veterans with college tuition, guaranteed home loans, and offered other benefits. It is not a coincidence that it was a prosperous white America which, in the mid-1960s, became more open, however belatedly and reluctantly and incompletely, to people of color, women, and immigrants. After a 1965 law ended the quotas that had governed entry into the country since the 1920s. A sense of comfort and of economic security helped create a climate of hope, and that sense of comfort and of economic security was the result of public and private investment in a broad range of Americans. President Eisenhower, a Republican, continued the work of his two Democratic predecessors, spending billions on Cold War defense and on the interstate highway system. Criticized by conservatives for failing to dismantle the New Deal and the Fair Deal, a dream of the right during the two-decade-long reigns of Roosevelt and Truman, Eisenhower resisted reflexive partisanship. Now, it is true that I believe this country is following a dangerous trend when it permits too great a degree of centralization of governmental functions, Eisenhower wrote one of his brothers in 1954. I oppose this. In some instances, the fight is a rather desperate one. But to attain any success, it is quite clear that the federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which the mass of the people firmly believe should be undertaken by it. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear of that party again in our political history. Eisenhower's essential acceptance of the existing political order was wise governance. But as ever, fear could not be totally conquered. In the same years Truman and Eisenhower were using the presidency to improve the infrastructure of prosperity, anxieties about foreign influence and subversion were growing. There was an atmosphere throughout the land in the early 1950s of suspicion, intolerance, and fear that puzzled me, William L. Shirer, who had covered Nazi Germany, wrote on returning home. I had seen these poisons grow into ugly witch hunting and worse in the totalitarian lands abroad, but I was not prepared to find them taking root in our own splendid democracy. Yet, here they were. In the closing weeks of 1954, during a long drive down the Hudson Valley to New York City, the conversation among the four passengers in the car, all friends, turned, as it usually did, to politics. One of their number, Robert Welch, a conservative candy manufacturer based in Massachusetts. Two of his most popular products, the caramel Sugar Daddy and the chocolate Tar Baby. Welch believed, and told his friends, that President Eisenhower was to blame for the Republicans' loss of both the House and the Senate in the November 1954 midterm elections. The president, Welch said, had engaged in a double crossing of his own party, refusing to campaign for candidates after promising to do so. The Congress had been moved a few notches further left by the defeat of several conservatives, he said, adding that this effect was probably intentional on Eisenhower's part. His friends expressed surprise, and Welch recalled that he then explained how Eisenhower, lifetime soldier, conqueror of Hitler, former Supreme Commander of NATO, and now President of the United States, was an agent of a communist conspiracy to undermine and take over America. With a rising worry about domestic subversion in recent years, Welch said, there had been some hope that the country was coming to understand the threat from Moscow. The American people, Welch later wrote, had begun to wake up to the extent of communist infiltration into our government and into every segment of our public life. Eisenhower, Welch claimed, had changed all that. The sad truth is that this tyranny was actually saved in this period of great vulnerability by just one thing, by the inauguration on January 20th, 1953, of Dwight David Eisenhower as President of the United States, Welch wrote. Subtly, cleverly, always proclaiming otherwise and finding specious excuses for what were really pro-communist actions, these communist influences made Eisenhower put the whole diplomatic power, economic power, and recognized leadership of this country to work on the side of Russia and the communists, in connection with every problem and trouble spot in their empire. Eisenhower, whom Welch asserted was guilty of a very sinister and hated word, treason, was not a lonely subversive or a solitary dupe. There were, Welch believed, plenty of others. One was Franklin Roosevelt, who, Welch wrote, had been swept along and used by communist forces, avid for the glory and the power of being a wartime president and of tossing around millions of men and billions of dollars with a nod of his head. Another was the former Army Chief of Staff and Truman Secretary of Defense and of State, George Marshall, whom Welch said was a conscious, deliberate, dedicated agent of the Soviet conspiracy. To Welch, John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, was yet another communist agent. There was no evidence for such fevered assertions. A classic conspiracy theorist, Welch fell back on a dictum of Daniel Webster's. There is nothing so powerful as truth, and often nothing so strange. Where the naked eye and the rational brain saw Eisenhower as a patriot seeking to govern in a nuclear age, Welch, his vision and perception warped by a fear of communism, detected treason. 4 years after his ride along the Hudson, at a meeting in Indianapolis, Welch founded the John Birch Society. Named in honor of a soldier killed by Chinese communists, the society believed itself to be engaged in an end-time struggle between good and evil. Of Birch, Welch wrote, "With his death and in his death, the battle lines were drawn in a struggle from which either communism or Christian-style civilization must emerge, with one completely triumphant and the other completely destroyed." It was language made familiar in post-war America in part by Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, the hard-drinking provocateur from Wisconsin. "Today we are engaged in a final all-out battle between communistic atheism and Christianity," McCarthy told the Ohio County Republican Women's Club in Wheeling, West Virginia, on Thursday, February 9, 1950. "The modern champions of communism have selected this as the time, and, ladies and gentlemen, the chips are down. They are truly down." Concern about subversion was hardly novel. The House of Representatives, for instance, had formed a Committee on Un-American Activities under the chairmanship of Congressman Martin Dies, a Democrat from Texas, in 1938. In 1940, Congress passed the Smith Act, which made it a crime for anyone to knowingly or willfully advocate, abet, advise, or teach the duty, necessity, desirability, or propriety of overthrowing or destroying any government in the United States by force or violence. The bill was wildly popular. The mood of the House is such that if you brought in the Ten Commandments today and asked for their repeal and attached to that request an alien law, a congressman said, you could get it. McCarthy, though, was something new in modern political life. A freelance performer who grasped what many ordinary Americans feared and who had direct access to the media of the day. He exploited the privileges of power and prominence without regard to its responsibilities. To him, politics was not about the substantive, but the sensational. The country feared communism, and McCarthy knew it. And he fed those fears with years of headlines and hearings. A master of false charges, of conspiracy-tinged rhetoric, and of calculated disrespect for conventional figures, from Truman and Eisenhower to Marshall. McCarthy could distract the public, play the press, and change the subject, all while keeping himself at center stage. Showcasing largely unfounded accusations of communist subversion, McCarthyism was about exaggerated threats at a time of real danger. Abroad, evidence of the Soviets' post-World War II ambitions was genuine and growing. By 1949, Moscow had a successful atomic program. In response, the Manchester Union Leader, a conservative New Hampshire newspaper edited by William Loeb, suggested a preemptive nuclear attack. We cannot sit idle and wait for Armageddon and destruction. We must forestall such a catastrophe, and the only way is to strike a proposed aggressor before he is ready to strike. The arrests of Klaus Fuchs and Julius and Ethel Rosenberg for passing nuclear secrets to the Soviets, Fuchs in Great Britain, the Rosenbergs in the United States, terrified the West. China, meanwhile, fell into communist hands, and the Korean War began. At home, there was the celebrated case of Alger Hiss, the urbane New Deal lawyer and diplomat, pursued by Congressman Richard Nixon, a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and convicted of perjury after denying knowing Whitaker Chambers, a confessed former spy for the Russians who had become a fervent Cold Warrior. And politically, the Republican Party was eager to win seats in the House and Senate elections of 1950. Domestic fears of communist influence were potent and might just make a powerful midterm issue. It was in this climate that McCarthy delivered what the Wheeling Intelligencer described as an intimate and homey address to the 275 guests gathered in the colonnade room of the McClure Hotel at the corner of Market and 12th Streets in Wheeling. While I cannot take the time to name all of the men in the State Department who have been named as active members of the Communist Party and members of a spy ring, McCarthy said, I have here in my hand a list of 205 that were made known to the Secretary of State as being members of the Communist Party, and who, nevertheless, are still working and shaping the policy in the State Department. The number of McCarthy's alleged communists was a moving target. His charges were constantly shifting. In the fullness of time, the 205 figure he offered at Wheeling wandered down to 57. He thrived on a dangerous but politically alluring combination, hyperbole and imprecision. Talking to Joe was like putting your hands in a bowl of mush, recalled George Reedy, a wire service reporter who became an aide to President Lyndon B. Johnson. McCarthy was an opportunist, uncommitted to much beyond his own fame and influence. His own lawyer, the young New Yorker Roy M. Cohn, could not discern any great ideological conviction in the junior senator from Wisconsin. Joe McCarthy bought communism in much the same way as other people purchase a new automobile, Cohn recalled. The salesman showed him the model, he looked at it with interest, examined it more closely, kicked at the tires, sat at the wheel, squiggled in the seat, asked some questions, and bought. It was just as cold as that. As Cohn tells the story, in late 1949, McCarthy was given an FBI report detailing allegations of communist infiltration within the federal government, particularly in the Department of State. It was not new information. A copy had been on file at State since at least 1947. In truth, the Soviets had made strides in penetrating Washington in the 1930s and early 40s, but a loyalty program had rolled up many of the agents. Now, in the waning hours of the decade, Cold War ultra-hawks wanted to press the case, even though most observers believed the matter largely closed. McCarthy was in. He said he was buying the package. Why? Roy Cohn offered two reasons. The first was patriotic, Cohn recalled. He was worried about the threat to the country posed by the communist conspiracy, and he decided to do what he could to expose it. The second? McCarthy, Cohn said, saw the dramatic political opportunities connected with a fight on communism. McCarthy was gifted with a sense of political timing. Sometimes he misjudged, but on balance, his sense of what made drama and headlines was uncommonly good. He had found, he thought, a politically attractive issue he could sink his teeth into. A few days after the Wheeling speech, a trio of Wisconsin journalists sat down with McCarthy at Moi Toi's, a Chinese restaurant on 3rd Street in Milwaukee. "Joe, I don't believe you've got a goddamn thing to prove the things you've been saying," one of the reporters recalled saying. "It's all a lot of political hogwash." "Listen, you bastards," McCarthy replied. "I'm not going to tell you anything. I just want you to know that I've got a pail full of shit, and I'm going to use it where it does me the most good." Thoughtful people correctly gauged the McCarthy threat. "McCarthy's methods, to me, look like Hitler's," Eleanor Roosevelt remarked. In a private letter, President Truman agreed with a correspondent who posited that "there is no difference in kind between Hitlerism and McCarthyism, both being the same form of bacteriological warfare against the minds and souls of men." Winston Churchill, in office for a second term as Prime Minister, added a paragraph to Elizabeth II's coronation address, delivered from Buckingham Palace on the evening of the June 1953 ceremony at Westminster Abbey, implicitly defending the Anglo-American tradition of fair play from McCarthyite incursions. "Parliamentary institutions," the Queen said, "with their free speech and respect for the rights of minorities, and the inspiration of a broad tolerance in thought and expression, all this we conceive to be a precious part of our way of life and outlook." On Thursday, March 30, 1950, at a press conference at his Florida retreat in Key West, where Truman could indulge his fondness for Hawaiian shirts, bourbon, and poker, the president told the assembled journalists exactly what he believed. "I think the greatest asset that the Kremlin has is Senator McCarthy," Truman said. The reporters knew they had news. "Brother," one exclaimed, "will that hit page one tomorrow?" Truman reminded them that he had instituted a loyalty program as the Cold War took shape in 1947 to identify potential subversives. The administration had found the ranks of the disloyal to be an infinitesimal part of 1%. The GOP, Truman said, was more interested in partisan advantage than in national security. For political background, the Republicans have been trying vainly to find an issue on which to make a bid for the control of the Congress for next year, the president told reporters. They tried statism. They tried welfare state. They tried socialism. And there are a certain number of members of the Republican Party who are trying to dig up that old, malodorous dead horse called isolationism. And in order to do that, they are perfectly willing to sabotage the bipartisan foreign policy of the United States. In his common sense vernacular, Truman added, "Now, if anybody really felt that there were disloyal people in the employ of the government, the proper and the honorable way to handle the situation would be to come to the President of the United States and say, 'This man is a disloyal person. He is in such and such a department. We will investigate him immediately, and if he were a disloyal person, he would be immediately fired.' That is not what they want. They are trying to create an issue." The net effect of the McCarthyite campaign, Truman said, was to undermine confidence in the country in a time of Cold War. "To try to sabotage the foreign policy of the United States," he said, "is just as bad in this Cold War as it would be to shoot our soldiers in the back in a hot war." Not every Republican signed on for McCarthy's machinations. On Thursday, June 1, 1950, fewer than 4 months after Wheeling, Senator Margaret Chase Smith, a Republican from Maine, issued what she called a declaration of conscience against McCarthy's methods. "Joe began to get publicity crazy," Smith recalled in an interview with the historian David M. Oshinsky. "And the other senators were now afraid to speak their minds, to take issue with him. It got to the point where some of us refused to be seen with people he disapproved of. A wave of fear had struck Washington." As Smith recalled it, she ran into McCarthy, who had flattered her in the past with the suggestion that she would be a fine vice presidential nominee for the Republicans in 1952, on her way to the floor. "Margaret," McCarthy said, "you look very serious. Are you going to make a speech?" "Yes," Smith replied, "and you will not like it." "Is it about me?" "Yes," Smith said, "but I am not going to mention your name." A frowning McCarthy, Smith recalled, then said, "Remember, Margaret, I control Wisconsin's 27 convention votes." "For what?" Smith said, pushing on. She rose a few moments later on the Senate floor. "I would like to speak briefly and simply about a serious national condition," Smith said. "It is a national feeling of fear and frustration that could result in national suicide and the end of everything that we Americans hold dear." She continued, "I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States Senator. I speak as an American. I think that it is high time that we remembered that we have sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution. I think that it is high time that we remembered that the Constitution, as amended, speaks not only of the freedom of speech, but also of trial by jury instead of trial by accusation. Those of us who shout the loudest about Americanism in making character assassinations are all too frequently those who, by our own words and acts, ignore some of the basic principles of Americanism. The right to criticize, the right to hold unpopular beliefs, the right to protest, the right of independent thought." Too few heeded Smith's warning. She was about 4 years ahead of most of her colleagues. While she did convince 6 other senators to join her declaration, a defiant McCarthy dismissed them as Snow White and the 6 Dwarfs, the Republicans were open to seeing where McCarthy's act might lead. "Joe, you're a real SOB," Senator John Bricker, a Republican from Ohio, told McCarthy. But sometimes it's useful to have SOBs around to do the dirty work. McCarthy's popular appeal was clear. He's unbeatable now, Milwaukee Mayor Frank Zeidler said in the spring of 1950. He's a northern Huey Long. His followers loved his style. His foes feared it. From a distance, McCarthy may have looked, by some odd reversal of optical principles, larger than life and of greater consequence than he ever really was, Richard H. Rovere of The New Yorker wrote at the close of the 50s. But he was large and consequential enough in those years. He was the first American ever to be actively hated and feared by foreigners in large numbers. In 1953, Eleanor Roosevelt, on a trip to Japan, found herself facing questions about McCarthyism. "Will you please explain these attitudes?" a Japanese businessman asked the former First Lady. "We are unable to understand why these things happen in a great democratic nation like the United States." Part of the answer lies in the nature of democracy itself. Millions of Americans approved of McCarthy, no matter what the elites might say or do. And McCarthy was not without support and connections in sophisticated quarters. He was friendly with the Kennedys, hiring Robert Kennedy as a staff lawyer for his committee in 1953, and taking two of the Kennedy sisters on dates. As an anti-communist Roman Catholic, McCarthy was popular in Massachusetts, and a hospitalized Senator John F. Kennedy would miss the McCarthy censure vote in 1954. JFK, though he privately recoiled at McCarthy's tactics and manner, chose to remain silent on censure, upsetting the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, including Mrs. Roosevelt, who long saw his failure to stand up to McCarthy as a sign of opportunism and weakness. They weren't far wrong. JFK wanted to keep the anti-communist Massachusetts delegation united behind him in his hopes to become Adlai Stevenson's vice presidential running mate in 1956, and, failing a step to higher office in the meantime, he did not want a McCarthyite challenge in his 1958 bid for re-election to the Senate. Challenged a decade or so later about his work for McCarthy, Robert Kennedy replied, "Well, at the time, I thought there was a serious internal security threat to the United States, and Joe McCarthy was the only one doing anything about it. But," RFK admitted, "I was wrong." In the early 1950s, legions of people were entranced by McCarthy's Manichaean vision of life. He spoke in the starkest of terms, savoring superlatives. Everything was dramatic, contentious, perilous. So few things, McCarthy implied, stood between American freedom and communist slavery. But one of those things, perhaps the most important of them, was McCarthy himself, who quoted John Paul Jones, "I have just begun to fight." How he loved the story of himself as the brave warrior, a story that dominated the newspapers of the day. McCarthy needed the press, and the press came to need McCarthy. He was fantastic copy, a real-life serial. The twists and turns of the McCarthy saga meant more bylines for the reporters, more exciting headlines for the editors, and, given the subject matter, alleged infiltration of the government of the United States by a fatal foe, more copies sold for the owners. Radio and television amplified McCarthy's impact. As Richard Hofstadter, the Columbia University historian, wrote at the time, "The growth of the mass media of communication and their use in politics have brought politics closer to the people than ever before, and have made politics a form of entertainment in which the spectators feel themselves involved. Thus it has become, more than ever before, an arena into which private emotions and personal problems can be readily projected, mass communications have made it possible to keep the mass man in an almost constant state of political mobilization. McCarthy understood the media's ways and means. "Things have to be done by a certain time," recalled George Reedy. And Joe somewhat instinctively picked up the absolutely vital course of the cycle. He knew that every wire service man had to have a lead by 11 o'clock for the afternoon newspapers. There just wasn't any question about it. You had to have a lead. The senator learned to make sensational charges at just the right moment, forcing reporters to write quick stories that surged across the country by wire, reaching millions of readers before sundown. The New Yorker's Richard Rovere reconstructed the rhythms of the age. McCarthy, Rovere wrote, invented the morning press conference called for the purpose of announcing an afternoon press conference. Rovere continued, "The reporters would come in. They were beginning, in this period, to respond to his summonses like Pavlov's dogs at the clang of a bell, and McCarthy would say that he just wanted to give them the word that he expected to be ready with a shattering announcement later in the day, for use in the papers the following morning. This would gain him a headline in the afternoon papers, 'New McCarthy Revelations Awaited in Capital.' Afternoon would come, and if McCarthy had something, he would give it out. But often enough, he had nothing, and this was a matter of slight concern. He would simply say that he wasn't quite ready, that he was having difficulty in getting some of the documents he needed, or that a witness was proving elusive. Morning headlines: delay seen in new McCarthy case, mystery witness being sought." He had no cause for concern if the whole thing turned out to be nothing, as so often happened. He had the headlines. McCarthy was becoming a more and more familiar arrangement of type, and was engraved more and more deeply on the American mind. His office produced weekly phonograph albums to send to Wisconsin stations that dutifully aired them. As described by the journalist Edwin R. Bailey, who obtained some of these recordings, interviewers, posing as journalists, would ask McCarthy congenial questions that led to senatorial disquisitions on the iniquities of the mainstream press, the Democrats, the communists, anybody, really, who had had anything negative to say about McCarthy and his methods that week. Television offered him ever-expanding reach. The number of TV sets in America quintupled during McCarthy's heyday, rising from 5 million in 1950 to 26 million in 1954. To McCarthy, the new medium created nearly unlimited possibilities to dominate the public consciousness, and he valued performance over substance. "People aren't going to remember the things we say on the issues here, our logic, our common sense, our facts," he remarked to Roy Cohn before the televised Army hearings. "They're only going to remember the impressions." The senator inhabited his own curious world, moving around Washington and around the nation with a coterie of aides, investigators, and reporters. He was good company. A showman at heart, McCarthy attacked the press in public, but drank and schmoozed with journalists in private. Amid hearings in the Capitol, he would adjourn for lunch at a corner table in the Carroll Arms Hotel, where he would take off his suit coat, have a Manhattan, eat a slab of lamb, order coffee, and muse about the action. McCarthy's headline hunting also benefited from the culture of journalism at mid-century, that the job of a journalist was to report the content of a statement, not to assess its validity. "My own impression was that Joe was a demagogue," one journalist of the era observed. "But what could I do? I had to report, quote, McCarthy. How do you say in the middle of your story, 'This is a lie'? The press is supposedly neutral. You write what the man says." Walter Lippmann defended the press in similar terms. "McCarthy's charges are news which cannot be suppressed or ignored, Lippman wrote. They come from a United States senator and a politician in good standing at the headquarters of the Republican Party. When he makes such attacks against the State Department, it is news which has to be published. Palmer Hoyt, the editor and publisher of the Denver Post, thought McCarthyism required a new way of reporting. In a memorandum to his staff, Hoyt suggested that neutrality was not the highest virtue. Truth was. Reporters should apply any reasonable doubt they might have to the treatment of the story. In other words, if a McCarthy statement was demonstrably false, the journalists should feel free to say so in print. It seems obvious that many charges made by reckless or impulsive public officials cannot and should not be ignored, Hoyt wrote. But it seems to me that news stories and headlines can be presented in such a manner that the reading public will be able to measure the real worth or value and the true meaning of the stories. Hoyt believed steady and informed reporting on McCarthy was the best antidote to the fever of the time. Believe me, there is nothing wrong with this country that repeated strong dosages of the facts will not correct, Hoyt told other editors at a Tucson, Arizona meeting in November 1954. Even McCarthyism will melt away before this treatment. When he read coverage he disliked, McCarthy did not keep quiet. He went on the offensive, singling out specific publications and particular journalists, sometimes at rallies. He particularly hated the Milwaukee Journal. Keep in mind that when you send checks over to the Journal, McCarthy told business audiences, you are contributing to bringing the Communist Party line into the homes of Wisconsin. To a Journal reporter, McCarthy confided, off the record, I don't know that I can cut the Journal's profits at all. But if you show a newspaper as unfriendly and having a reason for being antagonistic, you can take the sting out of what it says about you. I think I can convince a lot of people that they can't believe what they read in the Journal. The Washington Post had assigned the reporter Murray Marder to cover McCarthy after Wheeling. On election night, 1952, the paper's publisher, Philip Graham, told Marder that Eisenhower's victory over Adlai Stevenson would cost Marder his beat. According to David Halberstam, who interviewed Marder about the moment, Graham was sure that Ike's presidency would eventually mean McCarthy's isolation. Now that the Republicans had the White House, they would not need McCarthy any longer. But Marder understood McCarthy's recklessness and his hatred of authority. Party loyalty was not even an issue with the senator. It would not matter who was in the White House. No, Marder speculated, his beat was not finished. Instead, they would now need two people to cover the senator. Halberstam's verdict? They were both right. The Post expected much from Eisenhower. It is this newspaper's hope and belief, the Post editorialized in March 1952, that McCarthyism would disappear overnight if Eisenhower were elected. That was not to be. One sign of trouble, Eisenhower had flinched in taking McCarthy on during the presidential campaign. The senator had accused George Marshall of treason the year before, telling the Senate that Marshall was part of a conspiracy of infamy so black that when it is finally exposed, its principles shall be forever deserving of the maledictions of all honest men. In the text of a speech he was to deliver in Milwaukee on Friday, October 3, 1952, Eisenhower was slated to defend Marshall in no uncertain terms. I know that charges of disloyalty have, in the past, been leveled against General George C. Marshall, Eisenhower was to have said. I have been privileged for 35 years to know General Marshall personally. I know him, as a man and as a soldier, to be dedicated with singular selflessness and the profoundest patriotism to the service of America. And this episode is a sobering lesson in the way freedom must not defend itself. Ike never uttered the words. Talked out of it by political advisers who thought it unwise to antagonize McCarthy and his supporters, the voices included Wisconsin Governor Walter J. Kohler, Jr., and New Hampshire Governor Sherman Adams, the future White House chief of staff, Eisenhower always regretted his failure to say what he thought, and he hated that the world knew what had happened, for word of the dropped paragraph leaked to the New York Times. "It turned my stomach," General Omar Bradley wrote of the Eisenhower-Marshall-McCarthy episode. Unlike Truman, who openly denounced McCarthy, Eisenhower was patient and reticent. "Nothing will be so effective in combating his particular kind of troublemaking as to ignore him," the new president wrote in 1953. "This he cannot stand." The strategy was less dramatic and less heroic than one could have hoped for from Eisenhower, but it was his strategy, and he stuck to it. "I had made up my mind how I was going to handle McCarthy," Eisenhower recalled. "This was to ignore him. I would give him no satisfaction. I'd never defend anything. I don't care what he called me or mentioned or put in the papers. I'd just ignore him." Getting in the gutter with McCarthy, a phrase Eisenhower often used, would be counterproductive. "I would not have you believe that I have acquiesced in, or by any means approve, the methods he uses," Eisenhower wrote. "I despise them. But I am quite sure that the people who want me to stand up and publicly label McCarthy with derogatory titles are mistaken." Still, he did speak out occasionally. In 1953, McCarthy deplored the contents of libraries at American installations overseas. Cohn and David Shine, a hotel heir, took a highly publicized European trip, a kind of grand tour of censorship. Among other titles, the senator's staff targeted The Maltese Falcon and The Thin Man, on the grounds that the writer Dashiell Hammett, who supported left-wing causes, had posted bail for a group with communist ties in 1951 and refused to name names in red-hunting hearings. They also complained that the libraries failed to subscribe to American Legion Monthly. The European newspapers, Benjamin C. Bradley, then the press attaché at the American Embassy in Paris, recalled, were aghast. "What is America becoming to allow these people to go around and represent it?" was a typical comment. At Dartmouth College in 1953, Eisenhower alluded to the controversy. "Don't join the book burners," he said. "Don't think you are going to conceal faults by concealing evidence that they ever existed. Don't be afraid to go into your library and read every book, as long as that document does not offend our own ideas of decency. That should be the only censorship. How will we defeat communism unless we know what it is and what it teaches? And why does it have such appeal for men? Why are so many people swearing allegiance to it?" At 10:30 on the evening of Tuesday, March 9, 1954, CBS broadcast an episode of Edward R. Murrow's See It Now. Its subject? Senator McCarthy. Its means of storytelling? Images and recordings of McCarthy's own words. At the conclusion of the report, Murrow spoke more in sorrow than in anger. "We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty," he said. "We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. We will not walk in fear, one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were, for the moment, unpopular." Then came Murrow's final words. "The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies, Murrow said. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck. A few weeks later, on the evening of Monday, April 5, 1954, President Eisenhower walked down to the broadcast room in the White House basement. Featuring a handsome desk, special lights, and large prompters, the studio offered the president a convenient venue from which to address the nation. He had decided to try something new, a more casual speech, without a full text. There would be cue cards with a few notes, that was all. He would be seated on the edge of the desk and look directly into the camera. A fireside chat for the television age. His theme was fear and how America should fight it. Eisenhower is usually remembered for two rhetorical moments. The first dates from June 1944, when he drafted a letter accepting full responsibility in the event of the failure of the D-Day landings against Hitler's Fortress Europe. The second came in his January 1961 farewell address, warning about the military-industrial complex. His April 1954 speech about fear, which falls about midway between these landmarks, appears, at first glance, to be a forgettable presidential address, or at least a routine one. The remarks repay consideration, however, for in them Eisenhower described the disposition necessary to survive life in an age of strain and uncertainty. "We are worried about communist penetration of our own country," he said, "and we are worried about the possibility of depression and the loss of jobs among us here at home," he continued. "Now, the greater any of these apprehensions, the greater is the need that we look at them clearly, face to face, without fear, like honest, straightforward Americans, so we do not develop the jitters or any other kind of panic, that we do not fall prey to hysterical thinking. Sometimes you feel, almost, that we can be excused for getting a little bit hysterical, because these dangers come from so many angles, and they are of such different kinds, and no matter what we do, they still seem to exist. It is the American belief in decency and justice and progress and the value of individual liberty, because of the rights conferred upon each of us by our Creator, that will carry us through. There must be something in the heart as well as in the head." The end for McCarthy came in the months following the Murrow broadcast and the Eisenhower speech on fear, when hearings into McCarthy and the U.S. Army opened in the Senate. Behind the scenes, the president had maneuvered to detail the pressure that McCarthy and Roy Cohn had exerted to secure favors for David Shine, an intimate of Cohn's who had been drafted. The report of this influence, with its implication of an illicit relationship between Cohn and Shine, always denied by Cohn, drove the hearings. Day by day and week by week, McCarthy performed poorly before large television audiences, coming across as more gadfly than crusader. In an iconic moment, the counsel for the Army, Joseph N. Welch, attacked the senator, who had clumsily attempted to impugn the loyalty of a young lawyer on Welch's team. "Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness," Welch told McCarthy. "Little did I dream you would be so reckless and cruel as to do an injury to that lad. I fear he shall always bear a scar needlessly inflicted by you. If it were in my power to forgive you for your reckless cruelty, I would do so. I like to think that I am a gentleman, but your forgiveness will have to come from someone other than me." McCarthy blundered forward and took up the theme again. Welch was ready and struck with force. "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator," Welch said. "You have done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you left no sense of decency?" Yet a good bit of McCarthy's base of support remained loyal. After the Welch drama, Gallup found that while McCarthy's favorability ratings were falling, 34% of the country still backed the senator, a formidable enough number. "Unless we can get rid of McCarthy," an Eisenhower Republican senator remarked to Cohn, "he's going to be a mighty big thorn in our side." That 34% figure was the problem. The Republicans, Cohn believed, were worried that McCarthy could bolt the GOP, form a right-wing third-party ticket, and attract enough support to throw the 1956 presidential election to the Democrats. By the end of the year, the threat evaporated when the Senate censured McCarthy. The move to condemn him by resolution was the result of much of the Senate's revulsion against his reckless methods. Senator Ralph Flanders, Republican of Vermont, led the charge. "This matter is indeed a serious one," Flanders said. "The senator, McCarthy, has an habitual contempt for people. Unrebuked, his behavior casts a blot upon the reputation of the Senate itself." The senior senator from Connecticut, Prescott Bush, spoke out in favor of censure. It was not the first time that Bush, a patrician with a strong New England moral code and sense of fair play, had taken on McCarthyism. 2 years earlier, while sharing a stage with McCarthy in Bridgeport, Connecticut, during the 1952 campaign, Bush had criticized his Wisconsin colleague's methods in front of a raucously pro-McCarthy crowd. Now, with the censure resolution pending, Bush told the Senate that McCarthy has caused dangerous divisions among the American people because of his attitude and the attitude he has encouraged among his followers, that there can be no honest differences of opinion with him. Either you must follow Senator McCarthy blindly, not daring to express any doubts or disagreements about any of his actions, or in his eyes you must be a communist sympathizer, or a fool who has been duped by the communist line. The resolution passed by a vote of 67 to 22. 22 of the Senate's 44 Republicans voted to condemn. Once feared as indomitable, McCarthy was finished politically. He continued to drink heavily, and his health deteriorated. He died of acute hepatitis. His liver was inflamed, almost certainly because of his drinking, in 1957, at the age of 48. The conventional view of McCarthy's fall turns on his erratic performance during the Army hearings. But Roy Cohn believed something deeper was also at work. "Undoubtedly, the hearings were a setback," Cohn recalled, "but there were other, perhaps more fundamental reasons for his decline." By the time the hearings ended, McCarthy had been the center of the national and world spotlight for 3.5 years. He had an urgent universal message, and people, whether they idolized or hated him, listened. Almost everything he said or did was chronicled. That surfeit of attention, Cohn argued, itself contributed to McCarthy's decline. Human nature being what it is, any outstanding actor on the stage of public affairs, and especially a holder of high office, cannot remain indefinitely at the center of controversy, Cohn recalled. The public must eventually lose interest in him and his cause. And Joe McCarthy had nothing to offer but more of the same. The public sought new thrills. The surprise, the drama, were gone. To every